and Audible. If time permits, I will talk about prion inheritance and yeast prions, but since I got the sense we were nominally supposed to talk about evolution of some sorts, or that's what the topic of this, and since we didn't really work on it, I decided I would talk about one thing that was at least somewhat relevant, and at least it's more not so much that we have any solutions at all to this, but it's just something where a problem we're working on, I think, really trying to understand the evolution of the cellular chaperone systems I'm going to talk about is something that has interested me in a long time. So I'm really more trying to throw these ideas out and see if I can get any ideas from people with a very different perspective. So it's really centered around one experiment, and it at least has the word evolution in the title. It's an in vitro evolution of trying to make a certain chaperone system better. And I'm going to try to give some context to why we were interested in doing this and some background to cellular chaperones and protein folding. And so for the biologist, forgive me. For the physicists who probably even have heard this a number of times, forgive me. But I want to set up the problem. That will become obvious. By the end of, if you ask me at the end, I'll feel bad. So, of course, we're all familiar with the central dogma of molecular biology, right? That DNA is informational, that DNA is replicated, and then it's transcribed to RNA, et cetera, and it's translated to a polypeptide. And, you know, this is just a remarkable feat of engineering of how to make these complex molecules. And the beauty of the system, of course, is it's reduce the problem of making these incredibly diverse, incredibly complex molecules. So the DNA can code for anything, you know, from an E. coli to a human, and proteins are enormously diverse in their functions. And it's reduced this diversity to very simple, very reproducible chemistry. So making a phosphodiester bond or making an amide linkage in a polypeptide. And it just gets, this chemistry is repeated in a combinatorial way, and it lets you get this enormous diversity. And of course, because it's reduced this to this beautiful and simple chemistry, these processes are highly accurate. So replication has enormously low error rate, so on the order of 10 to the minus 8th, and it's because of this low error rate that we're able to have genomes in the size of human genomes of 3 billion base pairs. And of course, replication has to be extraordinarily accurate because it's an informational molecule, and any error would be passed on to all the descendants. But even transcription, which of course only happens once for RNA, is very accurate. So an accuracy of like 10 to the minus 5th. So a typical protein would have a messenger RNA of roughly 1,000 base pairs. In other words, 99% of the messages are absolutely correct. And translation, which is a harder problem because instead of having 4 base pairs, you have 20 amino acids you have to put in, and the 20 different amino acids are sometimes chemically very similar to each other. So valine versus isoleucine is a classic one, are very similar chemically, and there's elegant mechanisms for distinguishing between the two of these. Even this has quite high accuracy, so on the order of maybe 1 in 1,000 error rate. So again, no, 1 pound per amino acids. So their proteins start to have errors in them, but most proteins don't. Most proteins have the exact correct amino acid composition. But you do have to, it is something you have to be careful about, especially when you're doing a mutagenesis study and you get a 1 part in 1,000 1 part in 1,000 of an activity. The classic example was in the serine protease. This was supposed to be the catalytic residue was the serine. Early on in mutational studies, someone did an experiment where they changed the serine to alanine, and remarkably, they were able to get about a 0.1% activity, and it was all an artifact because there was 0.1% misincorporation rate of serine to alanine at that position. But nonetheless, these are highly accurate processes. And just to give you an idea of how good the engineering is on the system. So the chemistry, if you want to make oligonucleotides, has been well worked out. This is least one Nobel Prize behind this, and it's beautiful and very efficient chemistry. It's some of the best chemistry for making large molecules. And if you want to make a 60-mer by commercial oligonucleotide synthesis, the state of the art, there, about half of the 60-mers that you make are wrong. So. Amino acids, yes.
So every three or four.
Right. That's probably true. Of course, most errors are insignificant for the function. It's a rare amino acid mutation that's going to kill the function. But yes, there is this error. The translation error rate would be hitting just about the point where you think there might be some significant cost if error were to go up an order of magnitude, for example, or at least two orders of magnitude. There would start to be a much bigger cost. But as I'll say, because this isn't the point of my talk, and as I'll show, this is nothing compared to what happens next.
Okay, there's just one more question.
Sure.
Question your typical mutation is not functional, or whatever, you know.
It's not functionally important.
What's the chances of having a functional effect?
It really depends on how complex your protein. And how accurate, yeah. So, but there is, I'm getting ahead of myself. The most likely reason it's going to have an effect is because the protein doesn't fold. And that's really what I want to talk about. And I'll get to that with and why there's a much bigger error rate and why that's a much more, fundamentally much harder problem. Right, so, of course, at the end of the day, when you go through the central dogma, what you get is a polypeptide of a polymer of amino acids, and polymers of amino acids don't do anything particularly. Proteins function because they fold in specific, well-defined, three-dimensional structures. So, and it is it's only when you see the protein in its folded structure that you get a clue of its real activity. And structure-determined function is really, the central theme of structural biology. So, for example, here just two really beautiful examples are a potassium ion channel. If you were to look, and the myosin motor protein, if you were to look at these as chains of amino acids, you might guess that this has a lot of hydrophobic residues that lets it go into a lipid membrane, but that's about all you get from its function. And myosin would look like more or less like any other protein. In fact, it borrows aspects of G proteins that are used in signaling and then a variety of other different completely unrelated activities. But when you look at these structures, of course, you see that potassium channels can go into membranes and they form a core that gives you a nice quantum potential that catalyzes the desolvation of the potassium ion and then allows resolvation as the potassium ion goes on the other side. And it's size restricted so that sodium can't get through or other ions, biological ions, can't get through. Or myosin has an ATP site that causes a conformational change here and a lever arm so that you can get a movement linking the hydrolysis and the energy from the hydrolysis of ATP to the physical movement that allows muscles to contract. So the problem with the protein folding is that these are enormously complex structures. So these might be 300 amino acids, say, for a typical protein. Each bond might have several degrees of freedom, so you get 3 to the 100th or 3 to the 300th, and it quickly becomes vastly too much, too many different conformations to sample all of these. But I think even more fundamentally is that why folding is such a difficult problem is it's intrinsically complex. There's no simple way of subdividing it. There's no way of subdividing it into simple steps the way you can subdivide the synthesis of DNA or RNA or polypeptides. The folding is a highly cooperative process. The protein only knows it's gone to the right native state. It's only thermodynamically stable when many of these small interactions have been completed and completed with very high degrees of precision of their stereochemistry. folding can be very slow. So the proteins that are synthesized typically in minutes and can take hours to fold. And most importantly here, folding is highly error prone. If you just look, what fractions of the polypeptides that are synthesized actually make its DNA state, and what fraction are rapidly degraded by misfold and are rapidly degraded. Even generically, about 33% of proteins misfold. And what of all proteins made? Yes. Yeah, so if you... Yeah, so I think that is... that. There's certainly proteins that fold at much higher efficiency than that. Small proteins fold with high degrees of efficiency. Proteins that are secreted that go to the outside world, are like hormones or receptors, often fold with very low efficiency. So cystic fibrosis transmembrane regulator. This is a protein that's mutated in cystic fibrosis. And even when it's wild-type protein, somewhere between 70 and 95% of the molecules don't make it to the outside world. They're recognized as being misfolded and they're degraded. And the mutations that cause cystic fibrosis, at least the most common one and several of the other ones, are mutations which are causing that percentage to go from 30, the percentage that folds from 10% to 0.1%. And it's... How so? These are typical.
I understand specific cases, but the general numbers.
So this was done, and it is somewhat of a debate in the field whether there were perturbative, although there were some nice controls. But it was done essentially by doing pulse, by doing very nice pulse chases, very careful pulse chases, and there were some problems with methionine starvation. But that said, there were certainly controls in the paper for methionine starvation. And when you look at larger proteins, so proteins that are in the sort of mid to larger size, the 300 amino acids to more, they are often are inefficient in folding. Now in E. coli, the number is probably more accurate. It's probably a little more accurate. But in any case, it's clear it's vastly more likely to fail. That the errors in translation. Yeah, this is a mammalian cells, you know. Yeah, right. This is I think there's little indication that that is responsible. And the bulk number here is responsible for any errors in the message. That these are probably the vast majority of these messages are completely correct. Because there's very nice ways, if messages get damaged, there's nice ways of degrading them. So if you have a stop codon in a messenger RNA, or if you don't have the stop codon, let's say the message got clipped, so it, Right. The wrong, incorrect messages. If a message gets clipped in the middle, removing the stop codon, there's something called nonsense-mediated decay. The cellular machinery recognizes this as wrong, gets rid of that message.
When you say that folding can be very slow in nature galleries, you mean that really a cell sometimes will synthesize a protein and wait around for hours before...
Right. Even proteins that are made at high abundance. So immunoglobulin, IgM, something that... cell, an immunoglobulin, a B cell will be profession. That's its job in life. Everything else is life, is either sensing when to grow or not to grow, or is life support. It turns itself into a machine for making IgM. IgM, would take, I guess, a little more, tens of minutes to synthesize, but it takes 2 hours for it to get to the cell surface and to assemble into the correct structure. Some proteins fold very rapidly. Small proteins, 10 kilodalton proteins can fold in sub-second time scales. But complex proteins, especially proteins that are secreted, fold very slowly. So, and even things like influenza, a virus, viral protein, where it's really got to do a good job, it doesn't care about the long-term health of the cell. It just wants to make more of itself. The main receptor protein, influenza hemagglutinin protein, again takes half hour to fold to its native state.
Proteins that take longer to fold, are they more stable?
They tend to be secreted because there's specific problems with making transmembrane and making disulfide, the covalent linkages. They tend to be more complex, often self-surface protein.
Is there really a very direct relationship between the length of the protein and the length of the fold?
there certainly is, yeah, I think that's, whether that's been done carefully is not clear, because the type of people, there's a whole group of protein folding people who are more from the physical end, who like to work on things that have single, well-defined transitions, one domain, and try to understand the underlying physics of folding of a 100 amino acid protein, the minimal folding domain. And those, that's been well mapped out and reasonably well understood, although even then it's not that clear. And it's a very nice problem, because even for something 100 amino acids, you can't have a random search. So there's a lot of physics to the problem. So those fold very rapidly. They fold very rapidly in vivo. They fold very rapidly in vitro. They don't need Shelley or chaperone systems. And then these more complex proteins that are doing, especially the proteins in eukaryotic genomes, especially secreted proteins, communication proteins, are much larger and take much longer time scales and essentially won't fold in vitro. That's a great question. So how can you have, in the endoplasmic reticulum, an organelle, I say a lot that this is where all the secreted proteins, all the proteins to the cell surface go. There's an intermediate compartment where proteins are put in an unfolded form, and they have to fold in there. There's a quality control system that says it has to make a decision on that protein. Is that protein folded and it can go to the outside world and be presented? Is it misfolded irrevocably and it should be sent back to the cytosol to be degraded? Or should it be held there and given more time? And if some proteins take 10 minutes to fold, and then if they don't fold in the 10 minutes, they're degraded in 20. At 20 minutes, they're degraded, and others take 2 hours. And if they take, if so in that 20 minutes, they've not degraded. And there's starting to be hints of timing mechanisms where you make sugar modifications on these proteins that get removed one by one, and as sort of sand stopping to an hourglass, that when it's run out of sand, its time is up. But recognizing right from wrong is a major question. In the cytosol, there are ubiquitin ligases, these things that send things to protein degradation, to the proteasome to be degraded, in various sensing systems. But more generally, how you distinguish a protein on its way to the native state and the irrevocably misfolded one is a major question, one we're interested in, as are many others. Sure. Not that I know of that carefully. Yeah. And the right, or you could perturb the degradation system and say, does this help proteins? And to some extent, that is the case. So, in the case of cystic fibrosis, I'll give you a background of an experiment. It's an interesting one, I think, a lot of biology to it, and a major interest in lab as well is. For something like cystic fibrosis, where you know that the phenylalanine mutation that causes 70% of the mutant alleles, if the protein can get to the surface, it's functional. So we and others have done screens on proteins like this to get mutants, unbiased idea, to get mutants that would relax quality control. And with the idea that if you could then get a target that would be a small molecule that would then allow in a regulated way to relax quality control and let the mutant forms of cystic fibrosis get to the cell surface. And in other screens done in another protein that was related to CFTR by a different group, they did find the degradative machinery. So if you inhibited the degradative machinery, more of the protein got to the cell surface. But in screens that we've done, we didn't want to find out about the degradative system, so we picked a substrate and a variant of it where we could genetically knock out the degradation system, and it wouldn't pass our screen. It would stay in the ER it wouldn't get to the cell surface. And there we were able to get other types of mutations that would allow it to the cell surface. So I think the answer, the kinetic race, at least in some cases, is probably going to be part of the story, because if you inhibit the degradative machinery, more of the protein folds or gets to its right location, but it's not the whole story. So the other thing is that, not surprisingly, since this is the most difficult and the most labile step in making a protein, there are many diseases that are associated with protein folding. So, and these include inherited diseases like cystic fibrosis, spontaneous and probably most spectacularly even infectious diseases, where in the prion diseases like mad cow, you get a conformation that is able to catalyze the conversion of normal protein and thereby act as a novel type of infectious agent. And that these at least in mammalians, of course, these are neurodegenerative diseases that are highly undesirable, but there's increasing evidence in fungus and maybe in higher organisms that this type of prion-based inheritance or non-DNA, non-nucleic acid-based inheritance is actually an advantageous way of having having inheritance of different traits. And well, it's due to a mutation, and the mechanism of the mutation is not to inhibit function, because, and this is why I say it's folding versus, is that if you grow a cell that contains the mutant form of cystic fibrosis, the most common, as well as several other alleles of cystic fibrosis, and of CFTR, at 20 degrees, the protein gets to the cell surface. If you now go back to the functional temperature, 37 degrees, the physiologic temperatures are 37 degrees, the protein is active. And not only that, but when you look at 37, what happens to the protein expressed at 37? Gets retained in the ER and then gets degraded. Before it gets retained, if you look at the activity of the protein in the ER, it's active. So it's a problem with the folding of the protein, not the activity per se. And this is common for many different mutations. So there's a large number. Right. Right. I said that's certainly, although very different in mechanism. But so protein folding, there's usually a small number of residues that are critical for catalysis in an enzyme. But the target size where you're going to inhibit a protein effectively, especially for complex proteins that are difficult to fold, it's much larger for folding. So it's no surprise, in retrospect at least, although it certainly was a surprise as the data has been gathered, that many simple Mendelian traits are mutations are acting at the stage of folding of the proteins rather than the final activity. But in a sense, more of a surprise has been the spontaneous diseases. That comes to something. So the mutations in the cystic fibrosis, we understand why you get the disease, because you lose function of the protein. It doesn't get to the cell surface. It can't be a chloride channel. but it's not just the case that the mutations, that misfolding, will cause the loss of activity. That a partially folded form or a misfolded form can itself be toxic. And that's, of course, most spectacularly shown in the mad cow type diseases, the prion diseases, but also in a number of spontaneous diseases, including vastly more common diseases. So increasingly, there's evidence that Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, for example, are basically diseases of protein misfolding and of diseases where misfolding to toxic forms, toxic conformations, is intimately associated, if not the proximal cause of the neurodegeneration. And that leads to another link, an interesting link between protein misfolding and aging. So these diseases like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's diseases of misfolding are there's also not just neurodegenerative diseases, there are also systemic diseases of protein misfolding are highly associated with aging, implying that it's some, like many other biological processes, as an organism ages, misfolding, protein folding becomes less accurate. And there's just hints now that might not be, there might be more of a causative relationship. And the hints have come largely from C. elegans. And so people have a number of mutations in C. elegans that cause them to live longer, and at least in some cases, these mutations in homologous genes in mice have also expanded the lifespan. And one that a colleague of mine at UCSF, Cynthia Kenyon, has studied a lot is the Dower pathway. And I'm not going to go into this in detail at all, but effectively, they were now able to map out a pathway. And one of the main targets of this pathway that was causing the longevity was induction of chaperone machinery that's involved in protein folding. And if you couldn't induce the chaperone machinery, you couldn't expand the lifespan of the cell. And if you look, the lifespan of the organism, and if you look at the aggregation of a disease protein, the Huntington's disease, another human disease of protein misfolding, it will misfold in C. elegans, it will misfold in age-dependent manner. If you have a Dower mutation that expands the lifespan, that you expand the time that the protein will go without misfolding, and if you prevent the chaperone induction by this Dower pathway, you prevent the expansion of time where you don't get misfolding. So of course, there's now big questions of cause and effect. Is protein aggregation the problem with aging, or is that just a major factor of aging?
Could you say something about after a protein is properly folded,
right,
then what happens to it? Does it eventually become misfolded again, or does it get degraded from the properly folded?
Largely, there's usually a fairly large energy barrier to misfolding. The biggest, so complex proteins, I hate to be too much to generalize because I don't know everyone, it will be different for different proteins, but by and large, protein has only one, especially complex hard proteins, that their chances of misfolding, their lifetime of the protein is going to be short on the time scale of the misfolding and that of it unfolding. So once it's folded, it's probably going to be endocytosed or degraded in some fairly controlled manner. And now that might be because the biology doesn't want it to misfold, because once it's on cell surface, it's not in the cellular compartment where it could refold, even if it did unfold, so that you want to have a timer that proteins don't hang around for 30 years because they would certainly misfold over that time scale.
Persisting that are aging so much that they end up missing.
Oh. There's not, you know, you could always have a small percentage of cells that have a somatic mutation, but many of these are in our neurodegenerative diseases where there are post-mitotic cells, so they're not really dividing, so the chances of getting new mutations are pretty low. Seems to be something that the cellular chaperone machinery is getting stressed or is getting saturated more as aging occurs.
What's the role of chaperone?
Oh, so which is the subject of the talk.
Oh, okay.
So, of course, protein folding depends on cellular chaperones.
We're going to talk about chaperones.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, one question. If you have a mutation which is inducing this folding, the protein is really nothing folding.
Yeah, it's again the exact the difference is, you know, the exact sensing mechanisms are unclear, but physically there are common features to folded proteins that there aren't many different conformations that are similar to that have similar physical properties, one of which happens to be what you call the native state. Typically, if a protein is going to fold at all, it's going to fold to one specific well-defined conformation, and that by its rigidity, by the burial of hydrophobic residues, is really going to be physically quite distinct from other proteins. And in fact, one of the major things that cellular chaperones do is that they bind ubiquitously all misfolded or unfolded proteins, but they don't bind the native states of the proteins. So distinguishing physically between native and non-native proteins is not that hard, because they do have very different physical properties between them. But that's why the bigger problem is, how do you distinguish a folding protein from an irrevocably misfolded one? So not surprisingly, given the difficulty of this problem, there's cellular machinery loosely termed molecular chaperones. And I say loosely because they're really very many very distantly related or completely unrelated mechanisms to cis protein folding. And I think that's sort of the first clue that it's a tough problem. The fact that you have several unrelated classes of chaperones, right? There aren't several ribosomes. The problem of how to synthesize polypeptides was solved once. There aren't several fundamentally different types of DNA replicases, right? The problems were solved once, and the solution was good, and was retained. And of course, there's bells and whistles that have been added, ribosomes from eukaryotes of different components and ribosomes from prokaryotes. But no one doubts, I think, that there's some catalytic residue that's synthesizing the polypeptide backbone. In fact, we have a good idea which ones they might be, and that those are absolutely conserved, and it's doing the same thing in every life form on Earth. So the fact that you couldn't have one single solution that went out is a sense that I think the flip side of the fact that all of the solutions are imperfect. So other thing is, keep in mind, chaperones consume energy to assist protein folding. So most proteins, are the dogma is that proteins will fold spontaneously on their own. It's just falling down the energy landscape. Yet a lot of energy can be consumed by chaperones. And the ability to assist protein folding is dependent on the hydrolysis of ATP. And this is a common feature in a variety of different chaperone systems that have completely different evolutionary history and different function and different mechanism and work on different substrates. That is that the cocktail of chaperones can determine what proteins can be produced in a given cell type. So, for example, actin protein, a eukaryotic protein involved in motility, cannot be produced in prokaryotes. And as far as everyone's tried, and people have tried hard because it would be technically an enormous advantage if you could make mutants in actin and overproduce them in E. coli, for example. And we know the reason why it can't, because the cellular chaperone machinery that folds actin isn't in the prokaryotes, and no one can refold actin. You can produce all the actin you want, it's just in aggregates in the E. coli, and there's no good way of getting it back to the native state, short of... You maybe could. The problem is the chaperone that has it has eight different genes, eight different subunits, and probably some downstream factors as well. So I don't know that anyone's actually been quite brave enough to try this, although part of what I'm talking about, you know, one of the goals would be to change this E. coli chaperone, to evolve the E. coli chaperone system to, for example, fold actin. And that would sort of be the holy grail of the end of these experiments. And we're taking, well, described, if I ever get to it, is the first step in sort of in that process. So that's difficult to know exactly, because there are multiple chaperone systems. But for E. coli, this Gro-EL molecule that I'm going to talk about is responsible for folding between 10 and 30%, probably really under good conditions, more like 10% of the proteome. So the other thing I should mention is not only cocktail chaperones determines what cells can be produced in a given cell type, but especially in this context, is that there's now hints from the Linquist lab and Susan Rutherford that chaperones might actually play a role in buffering mutation, the effects of mutations. So this led to this idea that you could have an evolutionary capacitor where that you could have mutations that have no phenotypic consequence until the chaperone levels change. And so that as this cell goes to a different, an organism goes to a different environmental condition, you might have more or less function of the chaperone machinery, and this would then cause a difference in the readout whether a mutation in the genome would have a phenotypic consequence or not. And that this then puts a sort of interesting link between the evolution, the expression of a phenotype in mutations, and the environment that is important. I probably...
mean that things that before they mutated were folding in one way, after they mutate, they
keep folding that way unless there's a chaperone which makes it fold in a different way? That's what would it sound like.
Oh, so what the idea I think is more is that the protein would fold fine in its wild type or its mutant form under normal conditions. But its folding becomes much more dependent on the levels of the chaperone machinery with the mutation. So that if the HSP90, for example, is the chaperone that's been implicated in this, if that gets titrated out because of stress conditions or because it's expressed at lower levels or it's less functional levels, that you now have the mutated protein will now misfold or fold into a partially native conformation, which will then have a different function. So as you lose the chaperone, as the chaperone machinery becomes titrated out under stress conditions, mutations are more likely to be expressed as a phenotypic difference.
Is that a known stress response for loss of the chaperone?
It's certainly known that under stress conditions, the chaperone machinery gets titrated out, and it becomes strongly induced. But it becomes strongly induced because the chaperones become saturated with other substrates. And someone asked before what percentage of the proteins need chaperones, and it certainly goes way up as you go from the optimal temperature of an organism to stress conditions. And then the final thing, and really the takeoff point of this, is that different chaperone systems predominate in different organisms. So for example, the chaperone machinery in eukaryotes and prokaryotes, the predominant chaperone machinery, even though it's highly conserved, the relative importance of different chaperone machineries and how different cocktails of chaperone machineries are used is very different. And you know, this would be as if there were two ways of synthesizing polypeptides that had been evolved completely differently. And there's a non-ribosomal polypeptide synthesis, but in every organism it's a minor component, and the ribosome is what reads out messenger RNAs. There's only one way of reading out messenger RNAs. This would be as if you had two different types of ribosomes that were completely unrelated to each other, and eukaryotes, one was being used and the other was a minor component, and vice versa in prokaryotes, which again I think is an indication of the difficulty and the problem and how it has to adapt to the different requirements of the proteome that the proteome puts on the chaperone machinery. Oh no, they were very early. So the Groyel that I'm going to talk about is essential, is in every cell, and is essential for every cell. It's just in E. coli, it's the major player that's a very ubiquitous chaperone, and in eukaryotes, it's become specialized for things like actin and tubulin, really tough problems, and other chaperone systems have taken over. And what we're just starting to get hints at, or trying to rationalize or understand, is why, what is the logic behind? Is there some is this just chance, or is there some determinism that the different chaperone systems might have been better suited for the different complexities and variabilities in the proteome? So another example is this HSP90 that's been involved in evolution. That's in E. coli, it's in the eukaryotes and prokaryotes, and there's an HSP90 that's absolutely essential, plays a critical role in folding of secreted proteins in the ER in metazoans, yet yeast doesn't have it. It's completely absent. So yeast was able to eliminate the requirement for that chaperone system, even though there's every bit as much a problem with folding of secreted proteins in the yeast ER as in higher eukaryotes. So you have this interesting situation where there's really a competition between different mechanisms of protein misfolding, and there's some commonalities like the requirement for ATP, but they're otherwise largely divergent. So the protein I'm really going to talk about is one of the earliest, really I think the thing that really convinced people that the whole idea of molecular chaperones was true. And this is a Groyel protein. This is an E. coli protein, but as I said, it has homologs in archaea and in eukaryotes, and in every cell where it's been tested, it's required absolutely for viability. So there's never been a cell where you can get a suppressor mutation that allows it to live without this chaperone machinery, in the same way that you could never get a cell that would be able to survive without the ribosome or the DNA replication machinery. So Groyel is a really beautiful structure. It's a two ring stacked back to back. It's a sevenmer, so seven different subunits, and it's a homo oligomer. Sorry, each ring is a 7-mer, but the whole thing is a 14-mer. And it has a co-chaperone called GROES. the L and the S being is long and short because nature was kind to us and didn't make us find these independently. They're on a single operon in bacteria. One was the long and one was the short end operon and a bicistron. And GROES is a 7-mer itself, and it acts as a cap to GROEL. And there is a hole on the other side, but there isn't, you can't really pass through the middle. In fact, we know you can't pass through the middle. It actually goes back and forth. It's sort of, it's a beautiful thing. So the the substrates get grabbed by the in the central cavity by this ring of hydrophobic residues. And I'll go through the mechanism in a little more detail. But unfolded proteins get bound here while the folded protein here is being folded. Because if you have a cap, how do you get the substrate in underneath the cap? And the way you do is by having this sort of two-stroke engine where the unfolded protein can go here while one's folding here. GROES comes off, caps this, leading to the other side that can go. But that's not an essential component of, because we've made single-ring mutants where you get rid of this interface between these two, and if you just loosen up the GROES, it can actually function both in vivo and in vitro. It's more of an optimization on the whole system. And the thing that really got me interested in GROEL, really from the earliest days, even as a graduate student, was the fact that it was a general chaperone, that it seemed to be a general chaperone. It could assist the folding of many different unrelated proteins. And this really seemed extraordinary to me because it was the transition state. As I said, you can't decompose the folding problem to many similar types of steps. The transition states from different of the folding of different proteins are as different from each other as any two chemical reactions. So it's as if you had an enzyme that was a ribonuclease and a DNase and a protease all in one. They can all what? Right. Right. But you still have to have it. It still has to assist the folding of these different proteins, and it's not simply just a passive process. I'll go through in just another slide why I think it's not. Why I really think that this is sort of the major limitation on GROEL, and it is a remarkable thing that it can fold so many proteins. But I think in part this actually might be an illusion of the fact that the proteins that are produced in E. coli that need chaperones to fold had a strong pressure to be using the GROEL chaperone machinery. And it's this interplay between the specificity and generality of GROEL that's really the major point of what I'd like to say. So it starts off about, you can have a protein about 50 to 60 kilodaltons that can comfortably fit inside the central cavity. And we know from biochemical experiments that I and some others did in mid-90s, we had the basic reaction cycle where proteins were captured by the GROEL, by these hydrophobic residues in the GROEL central cavity. GROES came in, capped the polypeptide, dropped it into central cavity. ATP in this case was acting as a timer, giving a polypeptide a chance to fold in this central cavity. And then after hydrolysis, the protein would be ejected, whether it reached native state or not. So the decision between whether it's native and unfolded was at the capturing step, not the release step. And this could bind virtually any unfolded protein. So there's no discrimination between different unfolded proteins. The discrimination was whether the protein was the native or unfolded state. This was a sieve that decided which things needed the chaperone, and then the ATP. The energy of ATP was going as this timer system to drive the whole thing forward. And no, because you can make a single ring mutant of GROEL. It's an experiment I did as a postdoc. You made based on the structure, made a single ring mutant of GROEL, and the protein would be encapsulated within the central cavity and would not get out until you let GROES go. It does not get out the back door. Although there were speculations at times about that might be the mechanism that's been quite clearly disproven. Actually, there's a lot of density that's missing. It's an unstructured region of that that probably obscures that from going out. And it was shortly after this basic mechanism Groyel came out, this crystal structure of the Groyel-Groyes complex was solved. And it was incredibly gratifying because what we saw was that there's enormous conformational change upon binding of Groyes. So remember, these are these greasy side chains that hydrophobic that recognize the insides of proteins and distinguishes a native protein from an unfolded protein. Unfolded proteins are ones that are prone to binding other hydrophobic regions. They can then be captured efficiently. When Groyes came in, it caused enormous conformational change so that this hydrophobic region bent up and around. So it is now interacting with Groyes and was completely obscured. You now had this much more hydrophilic, electrostatically charged cavity, which would then be promoting the native state so that you would get this switch from a capture mechanism, which would prevent by recognizing misfolded, anything that preferentially binds misfolded proteins is going to favor the unfolded state. You would then have a switch to a state that would then favor the native state, allow folding to occur, then the hydrolysis, which would allow the release and drive the whole thing forward. And it seemed also to suggest a solution to this problem of generality. The only problem with protein folding were aggregation, that your stick a protein as it's folding is sticky and therefore will stick to other misfolded proteins. If you're folding inside this central cavity, sort of a Teflon box model, you're not going to have any aggregation. It can't see or interact with other folding proteins, and therefore it's given a chance to fold on its own, as if it were at infinite dilution. Well, I'm going to show that that's not the case. But that was sort of that seemed to weigh out of the conundrum. That were the only problem with protein folding, then this was a way of having a general folding machinery that didn't require knowing something specific about the transition state of each protein that you were folding. it's no more deep an answer than this is quite electrostatically charged as opposed to being hydrophobic. So the things that would most likely stick. But that said, it's clear that the cavity is not a neutral cavity, and I'll get to some experiments that show that. The problem with this infinite dilution model is you could reproduce infinite dilution by folding under increasingly dilute conditions. And there were several substrates now. Of the substrates that have been good Groyel substrates that have been studied in detail, I would say roughly half, where you can let them go as low a concentration as you want, and folding does not occur. And you know it's low enough because you know the protein is retained in a monomeric form. It just sits there in a non-aggregating form, non-native form, for essentially an infinite amount of time. And now you can add Groyel, Groyes, and ATP, and in an energy-dependent manner get rapid refolding. So here, you had no problem with aggregation, and you still had a strong dependence on Groyel for folding. So you really true catalysis. And now we're back to the conundrum of how do you catalyze a reaction without knowing something about the transition state? In some sense, it must Groyel seem to know something about the general physics of the protein folding problem in order to be able to do this. And it was really these considerations and also, sort of the frustration of having been able to do this, I thought, really elegant mechanistic work to show that proteins could fold inside Groyel and have it work so nicely with the structural studies on the Groyel-Groyes complex. And at the end of the day, having very little idea of why it was putting a protein inside the central cavity was actually doing anything to help the folding problem. And so, rather than sort of refining our understanding of the mechanism, when we took a different path, which was to get back to this question of, was Groyel really a general chaperone, or was this really the major challenge to chaperone, is to be a general chaperone, and is there a cost to being a generalist? And that was the background to the experiment, and with that background, it was fairly obvious, in a sense, what to do is, could you make Groeyel from being a generalist to a specialist? Could you evolve a Groeyel chaperone that was better at folding a particular substrate? And so, you know, and what would happen to its ability to fold other substrates? The substrate we used as a model system. So ultimately, of course, what we'd like to do is make Groeyel fold what its eukaryotic its eukaryotic homolog, which is called CCT, can fold. So, for example, if we can make Groeyel fold actin. But we decide to take an intermediate step and use a eukaryotic substrate, so a substrate that never normally sees Groeyel. And the substrate we used was green fluorescent protein. It was one that Aaron introduced, and we used it for a fairly obvious reason, which is that it only fluoresces in its native state, so it's really easy to see on a plate whether it's active and folded properly or whether it's misfolded. So, first of all, you've all seen undoubtedly many pictures, or many of you have seen many pictures of GFP. And what some of you may not realize is that GFP is actually a really poor folder, and that most people now are using mutants of GFP that are been optimized to fold properly. Because if you use the wild-type GFP, which was supposed to be produced in a jellyfish that doesn't ever see 37 degrees, or would not want to see 37 degrees, that it doesn't fold properly at 37 degrees. So, for example, you can vastly overexpress, these are whole cell extracts of E. coli, vastly overexpress GFP, and the result is virtually no fluorescence because all the protein forms aggregates inside the cell and so have protein in native state. If you overexpress Groeyel, you can increase the fluorescence significantly, but there's still a major folding problem. And people have used these plate-based assays to mutagenize GFP and to get better folding mutants. And this is an example of a commercially available, very good folding mutant of what happens when you overexpress it. You see, this is without overexpressing chaperones. You see that you improve the fluorescence greatly, and it's not changing the levels of GFP. It's more fluorescent because it's folding better. And even in this folding optimized mutant, this commercially available mutant, if you overexpress Groeyel, it helps it some more. And now you start to get almost quantitative folding. So there's a lot of dynamic range. Groeyel is a substrate, but Groeyel helps GFP folding, but it doesn't help it very much, since if it helped it, if it really helped it well, you'd be all the way up here. It means that you don't get if you look, break open the cells and you say how much of the protein is in native form and how much is in the aggregated form, or how much gets degraded before it can form aggregates, most of the molecules can fold properly. They were discovered by taking the GFP, mutagenizing it, finding the colonies that were brighter, recombining, and doing this for several rounds. And it's exactly, that was the other thing, is that the screen had already been done. So our screen, if we wanted to make Groeyel better at folding GFP, was all we had to do was follow their path. But instead of mutagenizing the GFP, we mutagenized the Groeyel gene and said, could you do the same thing? Could you get a better folding of GFP, but by keeping the GFP sequence into the bad folding sequence, to the poor folding sequence, but using a chaperone that's optimized for folding? Probably the biggest factor is temperature, but I don't know what chaperone machinery, or whether it's been studied what chaperone machinery folds GFP. But there is no reason that it would be particularly evolved to be folded by Groeyel. But it does show you that even though you have this jellyfish protein that clearly didn't evolve to be folded by Groeyel, although Groeyel's not great at folding it, it still helps some. So Groeyel really is a true generalist, at least to some extent. So mutagenized Groeyel, picked bright colonies, and we did this, and we got a few fold improvement at the expense of the coli being quite sick. And the experiment worked, though, because we used sort of a technical trick from this guy, Pim Stemmer, who actually did the GFP screens as well and has a large company, biotech company, based on this technology. And many of you might be familiar with it, but those of you who aren't, it's really sort of a nifty idea. And the idea is you pick round mutants that each, let's say 10 mutants, each would say have a point mutation that was assisting folding. Now, randomly, in vitro, affect a recombination. And the same type of recombination, at least conceptually, that occurs during meiosis, so that where you can get physical breakage and recombination of different alleles together. But here you just do it by randomly digesting and then sort of an inverse PCR trick to recombine the genes. And now you would get pools that where some would have no mutations, some would have mutants 1 and mutant 2 together, some would have mutant 3, 5, and 6 together. And so you'd be able to take your intermediate mutants and see, is there some combination of them that let you do better? And the answer is this really worked quite nicely. So we went through one round, and then a second round, and a third round, and by the end was able to get almost an order of magnitude better folding efficiency. Not only that, and this will be important for a subsequent argument, is that we simultaneously were able to select for E. coli that were no longer sick. So you couldn't say that they were just folding better because E. coli were growing more slowly. So by doing this double selection in these rounds of recombination in vitro, we're able to get essentially what we wanted, which is a GFP, a grow EL that folded GFP better without having a major cost on growth, at least at 37 degrees on the E. coli.
Did the cells have
their native copy as well? Yeah, so they did have at much lower levels. At about fivefold lower levels, they had their native copy as well. Although we showed in the end that the mutant that we got could support life on its own. So these are actually quite dramatic. Yeah. We have some ideas. We think it got sick because and this will anticipate something that's happening that I'm going to talk about later, because it was losing its ability to fold into endogenous substrates. And it was doing it in a dominant negative way because it was forming mixed rings with the wild type copy. And that really will, as I argue later, will be important for thinking about how chaperones might have evolved. Anyway, these are really quite dramatic, so either on a plate or in liquid culture. This is a culture, same density, either under white light or UV light, expressing GFP plus wild type grow EL, and expressing GFP plus our best mutant of grow EL. And just for comparison, this is the stemmer mutant where they got the optimized GFP folding. And what it's showing, I think, really is, I think, fairly remarkable, which is that you could do better by mutagenizing the chaperone and overexpressing the chaperone system than you could do by mutagenizing the substrate itself. And I don't think we tried that much harder than stemmer did.
How much overexpressed is the chaperone?
It's about fivefold overexpressed in this system.
What?
Oh, it does a little bit better, yeah. So this is a mutant not overexpressing. If the mutant, if you take if you overexpress wild type grow EL and you take the folding optimized, it does about the same. And then if you put them together, it does a little bit better, and now folding becomes close to being quantitative. So I think it really illustrates how the chaperone machinery can be every bit as important in whether a protein effectively can get produced in a cell. And of course, you know, if you were a biotech company, the big advantage of this would be if you've gotten FDA approval on your polypeptide, you can't go changing the sequence to make it a folding optimized one, because who knows if it's going to cause an autoimmune disease or some unintended consequences. But at the end of the day, you get exactly the same protein out. The grow EL is purified far away from this, so it gives you a practical way of producing a protein without changing it. What? Yeah. Oh, we didn't try it with fusions. If it got above 50 or 60 KD, it's probably not going to help much because it's not going to get encapsulated. Although there are mechanisms where grow EL seems to not require encapsulation. Those seem to be fairly specialized. So GFP being 27 KD, you'd have to get it in the intermediate. But that's an interesting question, whether it could help in trans. If you had a GFP that was actually folding quite well And the, it was the thing that was fused to it is causing the misfolding, whether it could help in trance or not. But we haven't really explored that fully. This one does not is not. This is just stemmers, how well you did by just mutagenizing the substrate. The second two are both, yeah.
Both,
right, and I'll show you, they, you do quantitative immunoblots, and they're expressing both the same levels of GROEL and the same levels of GFP. The difference between them is that when you don't overexpress GROEL or you overexpress wild-type GROEL, the vast majority of the GFP is in insoluble pellets. When you overexpress the mutant chaperone, about half the protein is folded. And then, like I said, if you now overexpress, if you use a mutant GFP and the wild and the mutant GROEL, now virtually all of the protein is folded. So it's certainly not, it's certainly still sensitive to that, to the intrinsic folding ability of the substrates. And it's interplay between the intrinsic folding ability of the substrate and the ability of the chaperone to assist that determines the ultimate efficiency. No, this is a folding mutant. It's not a chromophore. It's quantum yield and its emission and excitation spectra are unaltered by these mutations. Other mutations change the spectra to make them better optimized for the sort of optics and lasers that people use. But this mutation does not change the intrinsic fluorescence of the native state. It changes the efficiency of the folding of the protein. So this we clearly made a GROEL that was better at folding the substrate. And the question really was, had we really made a better chaperone, or do we have an idiot savant that is great at folding GFP, something the E. coli never particularly cared about, but has lost its ability to do its other things? And of course, we were selecting that the E. coli were not sick, so it had to carry out its essential functions. But there are, fortunately, GROEL is well studied, and there are a number of non-essential functions are certainly are functions that would have little effect on the viability of an E. coli at 37 degrees. So one substrate is a transcription repressor called HRCA, which is known to depend on the levels of GROEL. It's a repressor, so the more soluble HRCA, the less of your readout gene you're going to have, the beta-gal gene. So if you don't overexpress GROEL, you get a lot of beta-gal activity and not much soluble HRCA. You overexpress wild-type, reproducing published results, you get much more soluble HRCA and much less beta-gal activity. And whereas if you overexpress any of our mutant substrate-optimized mutants, now they fail, they largely or completely fail to assist the folding of HRCA. And sort of remarkably, our best mutant actually is acting in a dominant negative way. We were getting less soluble HRCA and even less beta-gal repression. So the one that was best at folding GFP was actually inhibiting the low levels of endogenous GROEL's ability to assist HRCA folding. We also do a number of controls and show that this ability to assist folding wasn't dependent on any of the other cellular chaperone machinery. It was really just dependent on GROEL itself. And looked at a number of other activities like phage growth. And again, we saw a defect in phage growth or growth at 37 was fine, but growth at high temperatures, an important function of GROEL, was lost. So just thinking about this, you know, sort of as a Venn diagram, I think that GROEL has a range of substrates. Those include the central substrates at 37 degrees, central substrates at higher temperature, and then various phage, HRCA, and REC-A, and then GFP, the optimum GFP, as at least, is sort of well outside of GROEL's range of substrates. And what the experiment did was to say, we want to be better at folding GFP. We'll select for better at folding GFP and better at folding the essential sub and still retain the ability to fold the essential substrates. And now we had, it's sort of if you're doing an optimization, a curve fitting, right? You want to make sure you're actually fitting, you're not overfitting your data, so you remove some of the data, some of the experimental points, and you see, does it fit those experimental points better or worse? And we could do that because we weren't selecting on phage or REC-A or mu or HRCA. And essentially what happened is we got what we selected for and we lost what we didn't select for. And I think this, so So the conclusion of this is that there really was a remarkable plasticity to Grolier that makes it possible to have a very big effect on its ability to fold specific substrates, but that there is a conflict between the requirements of the different substrates, so that Grolier variants optimized for folding one protein lose their ability to fold others. And
you don't know what the changes are.
Oh, we do, and I'll at the very end, I doubt I'm going to get to yeast prions, but hopefully I'll get to a little bit about what we're learning at the mechanism, because of course that was one of the major goals of these experiments, was to see if we could get something that was better at doing folding a particular substrate, that would get to this question of why is this, what are the critical features of the reaction cycle of that cavity that are assisting protein folding. So it's a way of, it's easy to, there are many ways you can break things, but the way, I think there are going to be fewer ways you can make things better. And the fact that we can now go to the structure function and do these mechanistic studies, it was a big appeal of doing this experiment. And that's really just starting now. But the mutants that we had certainly make sense, and I'll talk about them at the end. We actually did. So we thought substrate binding, that if you could bind one substrate better, capture it better versus the other, because there's not enough Grolier to bind all the nascent chains. So there must be a competition about which substrates are able to find the limited amount of Grolier. And we thought, well, you'd make mutants in the peptide binding domains, and that those would change the specificity. And we did this, and in the end, essentially, we did targeted mutagenesis, plus we also mutagenized the gene. We also PCR'd the gene for technical reasons as we were making the library. And it was the random mutagenesis that was that were passing the screens, and the peptide binding mutants that were failing. So we did, we just weren't smart. Yes, actually, Grolier is dependent on itself for folding.
If, how can it do it? How can it help fold proteins that are not?
Well, it's a 14-mer, and it folds as a monomer. So Grolier assists the folding. Typically, Grolier is involved in folding of monomer to the monomeric native state, and then oligomerization occurs in the post-chaperone reaction. I think it would be harder, and you would lose in other things. It's like putting your fingers in the dike, you know.
You essentially always lose for stuff you're not selecting for.
There was one substrate, rhodanese, that we didn't lose, and that might be because it's more typical of the essential substrates. But yes, if we looked, there was no particular bias. These were, HRCA is very different than phage. You could say two phage might be related in some general requirements of what the phages need, but HRCA or REC-A aren't related to each other, nor are they related to phage in particular. And we lost all of these, and we lost them fairly dramatically, at least in some cases. So, you know, with an N of 5, I would say, yes, many of the non-essential things, many of the things that you don't select for will be lost, and are certainly not improved. Oh, that was just... Right, so we had the I don't think it's particularly close to the center. You know, that's a projection of a multidimensional space onto two dimensions in a way that helped illustrate the point but lost some accuracy. I don't think there's something closer to the core of what Grolier does in the essential substrates versus lambda. It's just so distinguishable. You can lose one activity without the other, and probably vice versa. Yeah.
That's this issue of common aspect of the intermediate state.
Yeah.
If these substrates were reasonably globular, you might think that the unfolded state is just less compact.
Right.
And then anything that squeezes it will kill.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, that's a... Yeah, and how, so it will be, it will, that will, so one thing that...
Yeah. Are these substrates that are folded by Grolier reasonably globular, and the ones that are somehow more prominent, I don't know, like myosin that has
some... Well, actin's a perfectly reasonable, myosin's a big protein, is not folded by Grolier, or as far as I know, really by CCT. But actin is a perfectly reasonable protein. In fact, it's homologous to HSP70, and it's globular, and I don't think there's any sort of geometry that excludes it from being able to be folded. And in fact, there are bacterial homologs of actin now, and they are obvious. The experiment hasn't been done, but it's a good chance it'll be Gro-YEL dependent, or at least be folded by other chaperone systems in the E. coli.
It has to be recognized.
Yeah. Right, and I think.
So can one distinguish substrates that are not taken up from the cavity?
There seems to be very little discrimination on what's taken up. If you take whole cell extracts, virtually all proteins, all unfolded proteins, can be grabbed by the chaperone system. And that plus agrees with our mutational study. I mean, we thought that the substrate binding would be a great way of doing this. Now, in the eukaryotic chaperone, that's not true. In the eukaryotic chaperone, I think the specificity is, because there's a very limited number of substrates it really cares a lot about, there a lot of the specificity is in grabbing the right substrates. But that doesn't seem to be the specificity here. The other thing is there's G protein homologs that will fold by Gro-YEL and E. coli, and then another one that's involved in vision that won't fold, that can't be folded by Gro-YEL and is folded in E. coli, and it's actually a technical problem when doing the crystallography. And so there you had the same protein with the same protein with the same fold. In fact, you could even make a chimera that had parts of it that allowed it to be folded by E. coli chaperone machinery, and other parts that allowed it to function. And that was the one that was produced in the for crystallographic purposes as the quote-unquote structure of transducin, even though it was a mixture of the two.
So the experiment you showed in the Venn diagram,
yeah.
Is that done? So here there are a lot of potential. You're getting mixed rings in vivo. And so is the experiment you described done with the homogeneous?
The phage ones phage and HRCA were actually, we went back and we knocked out the endogenous copy to control for whether, how much the mixed ring.
What about, so if you look at the ability of the mixed ring, heterolink, how did their activity?
I mean, that's, I think, the critical thing, and that's sort of the thing that I think that is going to be a major governing force on how chaperonins are going to evolve, especially versus HSP70. And that's really the question. Well, I haven't solved. I hope I'll get back to this. I mean, the answer is we don't have that much specific data on the mixed oligomers, although we have certainly indication of dominant negative effects saying that mixed oligomers aren't working. And the question is, why haven't cells evolved many different Gro-YEL subtypes? So if each Gro-YEL can only fold so many proteins, you would think that the way of getting around, yet there's plasticity, so the individual complexes can fold different ranges of proteins. You would think that the way of getting around is to have multiple Gro-YEL homologs. And this isn't an idle question, because that's exactly what's happened in eukaryotes. It just didn't happen for Gro-YEL. There's one CCT homolog, and then, but in another chaperone system, the HSP70 system, there's been enormous proliferation of it and its co-chaperone. So there's 14 different or so different HSP70 homologs and 14 co-chaperones, and they seem to be mixed and matched, so you could even get much larger combinatorial natures. And many of the different 70s are in and of themselves essential, so they're not just redundant. And HSP70, I just show you a little bit of the structure to illustrate the point. It's working as a monomer. It's an ATPase, its fold is completely unrelated to Gro-YELs, its activity is unrelated, but it does have some generic things, which is that it binds many unfolded proteins. The affinity for the unfolded state, as with Gro-YEL, is being driven by the ATP state and the hydrolysis of ATP. So it seems to have settled on some commonalities, some common features of requirement of chaperones, but did it completely independently. There are several other chaperone systems, but HSP70, the Gro-YEL rings, are really sort of the major chaperone systems. And having gone to chaperone meetings for many years, there's always this sort of division in the world between the Gro-YEL and the HSP70s and people. And it was somewhere between, I think, boredom and loathing is the feeling between the two groups, because And the our pity, and I think the pity was because everyone, each group was convinced that the other was working on the boring molecule, and they all, both had very good reasons for feeling that, that they, and so the Gro-Yale people say this is this beautiful machine. It encapsulates proteins. It can take a protein from the unfolded state all the way to the native state, whereas HSP70 just bound short peptides and, you know, seemed to require other chaperone systems. But even beyond aesthetics, there seemed to be some good actual data to argue that that Gro-Yale was really, in some sense, a better chaperone. So in eukaryotes, you can delete HSP70. Cells are very unhappy. They're dead at 42 degrees. But, and they're pretty unhappy at 37, but then they get and pick up a couple of other mutations, and they do quite well. You cannot delete Gro-Yale. The cell won't even divide once. There's no suppressors that you can mutation to having Gro-Yale. And it's unlikely there ever will be. Then genomics started to come out more, and that still seemed to sort of help the Gro-Yale cause, because at least in some archae, the archae had completely lost HSP70, yet they had a Gro-Yale homolog, and it was itself important in protein folding. But the problem then came was, and really the people, many of the people working on HSP70 came from a eukaryotic or mammalian background, which is that in the eukaryotes, there was a Gro-Yale homolog, it was essential, but it was folding these couple of really hard substrates like actin and tubulin, whereas there's this enormous proliferation of HSP70s. And so why did HSP70 proliferate and sort of come to predominate in eukaryotes versus the ring structures in prokaryotes? And of course, we don't know exactly in trying to reconstruct these evolutionary arguments. Reasonings or teleologic reasons is always difficult, but I think this conflict between specialization and generalization, in particular the differences in evolving independent complexes when you have a ring structure versus a low order oligomer or monomer, I think might be quite important for this. And it's sort of a tortoise and a hare question, because you had this Gro-Yale that could fold, thinking it's sort of in these Venn diagrams, that could fold a wider range of substrates than any individual HSP70 complex. When you had a relatively simple proteome, so proteins were relatively small and relatively few of them, Gro-Yale was enough for all the hard problems. But as the proteome became more complex and larger, there was no single ring complex that could solve all the problems, could work on all the substrates. And now you could, of course, have gene duplication and specialization. But that's going to be intrinsically harder, or at least more complicated, when you have a ring complex because of this mixed oligomer formation. So you would end up getting a lot of the dominant negative effects that we saw, say, in HRCA folding or on viability. Whereas you can easily get gene duplication with an HSP70 and specialization. So the notion is, sure, gene duplication would work just as well with HSP70 or Gro-Yale, like systems, but with Gro-Yale you get lots of different mixed oligomers, and eventually you could evolve to form homo-oligomers of one color, one type and another type, but that's going to have a much higher barrier in terms of the number of changes that you need to make, whereas all HSP70 had to do was to proliferate and then it could specialize on its own without interfering with the activity of the other copy of it. And so there's sort of two exceptions in terms of this rule that you can easily think of. And that is if you had either temporal or spatial separation when the different chaperone complexes are being expressed. And that, in fact, does occur. So there are bacteria that have multiple different Gro-Yale subtypes in them, and they're under different stress control. So one might be induced by oxidative stress, another one might be induced by heat shock, another one might be expressed constitutively. And so now you don't have the problem of mixed oligomer formation because they're not expressed or not largely expressed at the same time. And the other is the spatial control. And I said that there's only one eukaryotic homolog in mammals of CCT, but in fact, it actually is a multi-subunit complex. And there is one subunit that there's two copies of. And the second copy is a testes-specific gene, and testes are making a ton of tubulin. So the idea, and it has to now go out and be tested, is that this swapping of one of the subunits makes the CCT specialized for folding tubulin. even better specialized for folding of tubulin. And then when you had a very simple cell type that really had to make a lot of tubulin, that was advantageous. Yeah. Right, and that's why I think they were getting sick and they were folding HRCA less well. Well, we got over the sickness because we selected for it, and it didn't get over the HRCA because we didn't select for it. But it was as much a constraint on the selection. It was easier to get... We did it both ways. In the end, we went... When we did the screen so that we didn't... When we did the screen, we had both. We had five-fold levels of the mutant and we had the wild type. And the cells were getting sick. It was easier to get cells that were green than it was to get cells, much easier to get cells that were greener than it was to get cells that were green and healthy. And then at the end, we knocked out the wild type copy error, put under a repressible promoter to show that the activities that we see were not dependent on the endogenous GROEL activity. No. It actually makes them thermal tolerant. It makes them better at folding phage.
So if you have five-fold more of one than the other, then in itself, most of the folding can be done by the
there'd be very few homogeneous wild-type complexes for sure. So not only do you get is a protein more likely to see the mutant complexes, but there's going to be you're going to prevent formation of a homogeneous wild-type complexes. The absolute level of homogeneous wild-type complexes is going to go way down because the chances of getting 14 of the wild-type when each one at each monomer is more likely four times more likely to be or five times more likely to be mutant is going to be diminishingly small. Well, we've certainly tried a number of designed ones based on that. There's large interfaces between the two. And we've certainly designed things that would prevent these interactions. And they work somewhat, but I think you'd need it to get a really strong specificity. You'd have to redesign the interface in a fairly major way. It could be that a point mutation. If you're really lucky, there would be a point mutation that would really give you a lot of specificity. I think that would be asking for a lot. But even then, it would need that point mutation plus whatever was causing it to specialize. And one would have to occur before the other. And there would be no selection for it to be a homo-oligomer. It's certainly not an absolute barrier. It's just relative to something like HSP70, relative to a low-order oligomer, it's going to be a smaller barrier to doing that. So as gene duplication would occur, it might have been faster to fill up the space with smaller circles that had fewer substrates but could be generated more rapidly than it would be to try to use this big machinery that maybe each complex could fold more proteins. There might be other limitations too, which is HSP70, the stoichiometry with the substrate is going to be less, so you might need less HSP70. So just... You know, in thinking about this a little more before I talk about the minute about the mechanism, one last point is, you know, are there exceptions to this? Are there ring complexes that seem to have many different substrates? And of course there are. There's, for example, two classic ones are nuclear pore and the proteasome. So the proteasome can degrade many different regulated or misfolded proteins. Nuclear pore is responsible for importing and exporting many different types of substrates, RNA, protein, many different types of proteins. But it's kind of neat how they've done it because they've both taken a similar tack in some way, which is to have a single or small number of types of complexes that are the central machinery and then use an adapter protein. So importance in the case of nuclear pore, the adapter binds to the to the individual substrates and imports them in, or ubiquitin ligases in the case of the proteasome. And then these adapter proteins would then proliferate and specialize. So you'd have many different types of importance, each with a different range of substrates that could then deliver to the ring complex a uniform substrate. It just So it's another way of getting around this problem of having a broad range of substrates for a ring complex. It's just one, I think, that would be hard to imagine how you'd implement for protein folding. So finally, let me just say a couple of things about where the mutations are and how, what we're thinking about the mechanism. And the answer is we looked at many different mutants, and they seem to cluster very nicely. One set clustered right around the ATP binding site in GROEL. And in fact, we could show for a number of these, this is an example of P8, that they were dramatically affecting, they're having a strong effect on the ATPase cycle and how GROES was affecting the ATPase cycle. And the notion would be then that this timer, that they would then affect the timer mechanism of how long a substrate would have to fold. And that this timer of how long proteins are given to fold might be a compromise between the different folding rates of all the different polypeptides, but not optimized for any. And so what we might have been doing was changing the timer so that it was better at GFP, but then it would be worse for some other substrates. And there's hints even with HSP70 that mutations that change specificity also change the ATPase rate. So changing the rate of the reaction might be a general way of changing the specificity of substrate range of a chaperone system. And then the second set of mutations were clustered at a single residue, and we got multiple hits in this residue, multiple different types of mutations. That was within GROES itself, a single tyrosine residue that didn't seem to be involved in the allosteric or the conformational changes, but instead was sticking straight to where the central cavity would be. So remember, GROEL is a ring complex. Proteins would be folding inside this ring, and although it's only a single residue, this tyrosine, because you have sevenfold symmetry, it's going to have a strong effect on the electrostatic properties or the chemical properties of the folding lid. So this is looking at the outer view, not where the substrate sees of GROES, or the inner view of GROES. That's the cap to the folding cavity. And we would see that these mutations that we're picking up could have dramatic effect on the electrostatic potential of the folding cap. And in fact, we could find that this mutation alone was sufficient to assist folding, and this is a nice demonstration of that. If you overexpress wild-type GROEL and GROES, it assists you. You get a somewhat brighter GFP. If you use hydrophobic, so chemically similar residues to the tyrosine, it doesn't do anything. A histidine, which is partially charged, it helps a little bit, and then either positively, negatively charged, or some polar residues can have a much more dramatic effect. So it's just like another illustration of why this is not a Teflon box at all. This is that the chemical environment of the box is determining the substrate specificity and how it assists the folding of different substrates. And of course, the major challenge, from a physical point of view now, is trying to understand why the different chemical environments for different substrates are going to change the range of proteins and how different folding reactions are going to be sensitive to this. But again, just to finish with sort of a physical picture, is that this is not, the substrates really are strongly confined within this cavity. If you look at a typical 30 kD protein and model it, there can be at most two or three water molecules between the substrate, even if it's in a compact molten globule-like state, and the outer cavity. So the notion that the environment of the outer cavity was not going to affect the folding transition state, I think, was just not physically realistic. And now, trying to understand how this is working and whether there is some general feature of confinement in the electrostatic box that is allowing it to act as a general chaperone, and then these fine tunings of what the chemical environment is and what the timing of the reaction cycle is, gives it specificity, is sort of where the mechanism, or at least where my interest in the mechanism is going. And yeah, I think I'll finish.
Can the GROEL fold larger proteins than one part of its space hanging out in the other parts?
So for most things, it can't fold proteins. If you look at what proteins are encapsulated by GROEL, there's a strict cutoff at about 50 or 60 kD. It turns out for probably a very limited number of substrates, there's a mechanism, a so-called trans mechanism, where the proteins, GROES is on this side and the substrate's on that side, and it's assisting its folding. How general that mechanism isn't clear, but with the, certainly in the cis mechanism, there's no way for a polypeptide to hang out because it's forming a tight cap on it.
Can you imagine that the chaperones act like a sort of a mediation way to nuclear closing? Do they do that? Does Growell do that?
Nuclear?
Yeah, they nucleate the folding in some way that something sticks inside and it folds up and then it leaves and then it can fold on its own from that.
Oh, yeah. So what is the state after which it's released? Certainly things can reach their native state while they're inside Groyel. So what we did is we made mutants that essentially set the timer to infinity. So you'd get one round of binding and then encapsulation within the central cavity. And proteins would not only fold there and they would remain native inside the central cavity, but they'd fold at the same rate as if they were binding and being bound and released. So for the substrates we've looked at, there's not really good evidence for effect happening afterwards. And actually, there's a very nice experiment that just came out from Ora Cardell's lab that addressed this. And what they did was they had a way, they put biotin on their Groyel, and that the Groyel is perfectly functional, but then they could add avidin, which was big, that would effectively remove the Groyel from the solution. It could now no longer bind substrates. So if a substrate was in there, it was fine. It wasn't going to be affected by the avidin. But once Groyel comes off and the avidin comes in, that it's more, with some nice controls, more or less neutral to the whole thing. And as soon as you do that, folding stops, dead. Not only that, but if you have a substrate that's being catalyzed, so it's folding four times faster inside the cavity than outside the cavity, as soon as you add avidin, it goes from the fast rate to the slow rate. So we really believe that the key events in the catalysis are occurring while the substrates are encapsulated in the Groyel-Groyes complex, at least for these standard intermediate size substrates.
So the two mechanisms for the two classes of mutants interact with each other, so if you instruct them to
have both things,
would that help
more? Right. So what happens when you add them? So our final mutant, of course, contained a combination of the two. We were only get the highest rate by combining the two. But the best Groyes and the best Groyel did not combine well with each other. It was an intermediate Groyes and the best Groyel that were ultimately the best ones. And that was in part because you took the best Groyes and it made the cells a little bit sick. The best Groyel didn't. Best Groyel was in the final mutant, actually. But you put those two together and the cells were considerably more sick. So whether it was the sickness of the cells, as opposed to how well the complex, say, would work if you didn't have these other considerations, wasn't clear. But that certainly is the next thing, is how is the interplay between the kinetics and the environment of the encapsulation cavity interplay? What's the interplay between those two?
Can you make this whole work in because if you made aggregated
DFT? Yeah. So this is the real problem. The answer is it accelerates the folding just a little bit, but not a lot. But the problem is GFP, while it's a beautiful substrate for the in vivo things, is a lousy substrate for in vitro. Because if you have the chromophore intact, it doesn't need Groyel, Groyes. And if you don't have the chromophore intact, all the kinetics are being dominated by chromophore formation. Now, we've tried to do some competition experiments, and you can get a small difference, but it was relatively small. And I think, in our mind, it points to another really major, I just didn't get into that because it's a complication, but another major area that this has really made me think a lot more about, which is how much does this rarefied dilute reaction that we're looking at really reflect what's limiting protein folding in the cell? Because we did very careful controls, knocked out every other chaperone system, did microarray experiments to show that other chaperone or other protease systems weren't being induced, and pulse chase experiments to show that GFP was going on the Groyel and then coming off. Yet in vitro, the effects are much more modest. And it really points to things, you could say excluded volume, or you could say competition between substrates that's critical. But the bottom line is, despite all that we know about it, despite the fact that it's clear that the reaction cycle is being affected in a rational way, why this is affecting folding is we don't understand, and what it is about in vivo that it's having such a big effect, we really don't understand.
Is Groyel used for chaperone for other protein substrates in vitro?
Oh, yeah. So Groyal helps GFP in vitro, as does the mutant, and Groyal helps many, you can reconstitute a folding reaction in vitro. In fact, that's been, you know, it's easy to do, and it's been the subject of many, many different papers. So in fact, this is really a red flag saying that you could certainly overinterpret differences in the efficiency of folding in vitro reaction that might have no relevance to what's going on inside a cell. Or for that matter, the critical features of why Groyal is so good at helping folding in a cell, while they are dependent on encapsulation and the ATPase, what's really limiting the cell is not clear. Right? Thanks.